Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, The Life Project, The Extraordinary Story of 70. Ziri Ordinary Lives is Helen Pearson's account of the British birth cohort studies. A sequence of long-running investigations that began by recording the lives of babies born in Britain during 1 week in March 1946. Pearson, a science journalist and editor at Nature, writes in the tradition of narrative science, combining social history, public health, education research, and biography of research institutions. The book explains how the studies expanded across later generations, including cohorts born in 1958, 1970, the early 1990s, and around the turn of the millennium. Its purpose is not simply to celebrate an unusual scientific archive, but to show how repeated observation across a lifetime can reveal patterns that short-term research often misses. Pearson uses the studies to examine how birth, class, schooling, family circumstances, health behavior, and public policy interact over decades to shape ordinary lives. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, the 1946 birth survey turned post-war anxiety into a new model of social research. A central topic in the Life Project is the improbable origin of the British cohort studies. The first study emerged in a Britain still marked by war, austerity, population concerns, and uncertainty about maternal and infant health. By trying to record nearly every baby born in 1 week in March 1946, researchers created a snapshot of national birth conditions at a moment of reconstruction. Pearson emphasizes that the project was not designed at first as a grand, lifelong experiment. Its importance grew because researchers continued to return to the same children, transforming a birth survey into a longitudinal study of development. This beginning matters because it shows how scientific value can arise from persistence as much as from initial design. A one-time survey could reveal conditions surrounding childbirth, but repeated follow-up could connect those conditions to schooling, work, family formation, illness, and aging. Pearson presents the studies as a product of public purpose, as well as scientific ambition. They depended on health visitors, government cooperation, academic institutions, and the willingness of families to answer detailed questions. The book, therefore, treats the 1946 project as a social invention, not merely a data collection exercise. Secondly, longitudinal evidence reveals links that isolated measurements cannot show. Pearson gives sustained attention to the distinctive power of longitudinal cohort research. Instead of asking different people questions at a single point in time, the studies repeatedly examine the same people as their circumstances change. This structure allows researchers to connect early conditions with later outcomes, while also observing how later events modify earlier risks. The reasoning is important because many life outcomes are cumulative. Health, education, and social mobility are shaped by chains of exposure, opportunity, stress, and support, not by one isolated cause. The book shows why large cohorts are especially valuable. They make it possible to detect broad patterns while still preserving the sequence of individual lives. Pearson does not present cohort research as flawless proof of causation, but she explains why it has a stronger evidentiary role than anecdote or short-term surveys. By following people over decades, researchers can test assumptions that may seem obvious only after data confirm them, such as the consequences of smoking, poverty, schooling, and family resources. The method also exposes delayed effects, including how childhood disadvantage can reappear in adult health or economic status. In this sense, the studies become a scientific memory of social change. Thirdly, childhood disadvantage is shown as cumulative rather than merely personal. One of the book's most significant themes is the relationship between early life conditions and later inequality. The cohort studies repeatedly demonstrate that children do not begin life from equivalent positions. Family income, parental education, housing, health, nutrition, and school environment shape the range of opportunities available long before individuals make adult choices. Pearson is careful to present this not as a deterministic argument, but as a cumulative one. Early disadvantage can limit school achievement, which can influence qualifications, employment, earnings, health, and the next generation's conditions. The value of the cohort evidence is that it turns broad moral claims about inequality into measurable life patterns. It also complicates simple explanations of success and failure. When researchers can compare thousands of people over time, they can see that personal effort operates within unequal structures of support and constraint. Pearson's treatment of social mobility is especially important because it connects personal biographies to policy questions. If poor outcomes are partly rooted in early preventable conditions, then education, maternal health, housing, and family support become matters of long-term public investment rather than temporary assistance. The book, therefore, makes inequality visible as a life course process. Fourthly, the studies change policy by linking private experiences to national evidence. The LIFE project highlights how the cohort studies influence public understanding and, at times, policy decisions in Britain. Their findings helped clarify issues in childbirth, schooling, smoking, parenting, social mobility, and aging because they connected personal circumstances to national patterns. This is one reason Pearson presents the studies as a public resource rather than a narrow academic achievement. A government can debate education or health policy using ideology, but cohort data provide evidence about how policies and social conditions actually affect people over time. The book also shows that the studies cross disciplinary boundaries. Medical researchers, sociologists, economists, psychologists, demographers, and education specialists can all use the same long-term records to ask different questions. That breadth distinguishes the cohorts from studies confined to one field. Pearson's account makes clear, however, that evidence does not automatically produce policy. Findings must be interpreted, communicated, funded, and politically accepted. The studies may reveal strong associations between deprivation and later outcomes, but the response depends on public priorities and institutional capacity. By tracing this tension, Pearson avoids treating data as a simple solution. Instead, she shows how long-term evidence can widen the range of responsible public choices. Lastly, the project depends on trust, funding, and the continued cooperation of ordinary participants. Pearson also examines the fragile human and institutional conditions that make such research possible. The phrase 70,000 ordinary lives points to a central paradox. The studies are scientifically extraordinary because ordinary people repeatedly allowed researchers into private areas of their lives. Participants answered questions about family, health, income, education, habits, and aging across many decades. Without that cooperation, the most elegant research design would collapse. The book, therefore, gives attention to the practical labor of maintaining contact. Designing questionnaires, securing funding, adapting to new scientific questions, and protecting the value of long-term data. This topic matters because longitudinal studies are vulnerable to attrition, budget cuts, administrative changes, and shifts in public trust. If too many participants disappear, or if funding lapses, the continuity that gives the data its power is weakened. Pearson presents the researchers not as detached collectors of facts, but as custodians of a national scientific inheritance. At the same time, the book implies ethical responsibilities. Long-term studies must respect privacy, avoid reducing people to variables, and justify the burden placed on participants by producing knowledge of public value. The durability of the project is therefore both a scientific and civic achievement. In conclusion, the LIFE Project is best suited to readers interested in narrative science, social history, public health, education, sociology, and evidence-based policy. It will also be useful for researchers, teachers, journalists, and policymakers who want a readable explanation of why longitudinal data matters. The practical benefit of the book is that it trains readers to think across time. It shows that childhood health, schooling, family income, and social conditions are not isolated episodes, but linked stages in a life course. Intellectually, it offers a concrete example of how large-scale evidence can challenge assumptions about merit, inequality, and personal responsibility without eliminating the role of individual variation. What makes the book stand out among popular science works is its focus on a research infrastructure rather than on a single discovery, charismatic scientist, or dramatic experiment. Pearson's subject is the slow accumulation of knowledge through repeated measurement, institutional persistence, and participant trust, compared with books that summarize behavioral science findings in abstract terms. This one anchors its claims in a distinctive national archive, and in the changing history of post-war Britain. Its strength lies in showing how ordinary lives, studied carefully and respectfully over decades, can become one of the most powerful sources of knowledge about health, opportunity, and social change. If you would like to support Helen Pearson, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.